From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to the markets, which we've been watching all week as they've gone up and down, although mostly down. There was a rebound at the open this morning on Wall Street, but the Dow has lost about 10% of its value in the last week. And it was another down day in China. The Shanghai Composite closed down around 1%. And when markets fall like this around the world, a lot of people start asking a lot of questions about other potential weaknesses in the economy that may have been overlooked before. So let's kick the tires right now with CNN's Maggie Lake, who joins us now. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Jeremy. I like the way you put it.
Well, yeah, let's check out the housing market here, because this is what took down the U.S. economy last time. And, you know, a lot of reasonable questions about whether the growth in housing has really been as good as we see in some places in this country. How's the housing market doing?
Yeah, and you're right. We need to ask this because I think we're all paranoid. We're still so scarred from what happened from the financial crisis. When you look at housing in the U.S., it looks really solid. We're in a solid recovery. When you look at any measures, housing starts, existing home sales, they're sitting at eight-year highs. Home prices are expected to rise about 5% this year, 4% next year. Nothing too crazy, but a nice steady climb. And even if the Fed raises rates, you have to remember mortgage rates still historically very, very low. So that is expected to continue to lend some support. If there's any thing holding about the housing market here in the U.S., it's our student debt, but that's a more structural issue about home creation. That is not really related to the volatility we're seeing in markets.
You know, that's another good thing to think about is student debt, because some people look at that and say this is a big debt bubble just like housing was.
Yeah, and that's what happens. I mean, when you've got these big credit moves, it's hard to sustain them long term. A lot of people say we're not talking enough about student debt, especially as we enter a presidential year. Mm. How are we going to work that down? So it is on the radar, but it's not one of those things, because most of it is held by the government at this point. It's not one of those things people feel like it has that systemic risk that when you're bursting a credit bubble held by banks, bundled into loans that we didn't understand. It doesn't seem that same way right now.
Well, that brings us to the banks. How are the banks doing in this country right now?
Broadly, they're also looking good. You know, they went through a lot of changes after the financial crisis, all those capital requirements, the regulators and auditors sitting in the institutions. And so, listen, the ones that rely more on investment banking trading, you may see them get hit a little bit by the volatility. They have more of an international focus. But banks that are more focused on the consumer, and that's more and more of them, by the way, you know, thinking big ones, Bank of America, even Goldman bought some deposits from Berkshire Hathaway recently. You know, that's going to help buffer them. And, you know, they have all these stress tests put in place. In fact, I asked one person, in this all this volatility, are we worried about a long-term capital management? He said, listen, we still have a long way to go with regulation, but those changes that were put in place about levered borrowing, about, you know, really going on margin, a lot of things have changed. So it's less likely you see a hedge fund imploding because of all of this. So it does look like we learned some lessons along the way when it came to banking.
Okay. What about the parts of our economy that are tied more directly to China? Mining comes up. The mining companies have been way down in the stock market. Mm-hmm. Caterpillar, based in Illinois, announced this week that it's going to lay off hundreds of workers. So what should we be looking at in terms of parts of the economy that are directly tied to what's going on in China?
So all of us are exposed in the world to the Chinese economy. It's the second largest. Anything that's industrial, commodity-based, the pain's probably going to continue. But if you're gearing toward the consumer, a lot of people think those worries are overdone. The Chinese authorities want their economy to become a consumer-led, service-led economy. That's where they're going to put their stimulus. So people think, you know, maybe after we get through this little period, you're going to look at people that sell to the Chinese consumer and say, you know what, maybe they're not that bad. I know Apple got hit. We looked at a lot of other, you know, yum brands.
Yeah.
People may be not so sure. Maybe they'll be in a little bit better shape, but definitely those industrial commodity-based sectors are going to continue to struggle.
CNN's Maggie Lake, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to those wildfires in Washington state, which have gotten so bad, the crews getting stretched so thin, that firefighters from New Zealand and Australia have flown in to help. And now, in an unprecedented move, the state has asked civilians to help as well. Some residents have donated their bulldozers to the cause, and those who are qualified are volunteering to fight the fires on the front line. Joe Smiley is with Washington's Department of Natural Resources. He's in Omak, a few miles from the Okanagan complex of fires, which have become the largest in state history. And Joe, this raises so many questions, like how do you know these people are qualified? I mean, you really have to be needing help to ask people who haven't done this before, because we know how hard it is.
Right, and it's been quite the effort to verify the people that we have gotten. Fortunately, those that are qualified are registered in a roster, and so we can double check that and verify what they say is true and that they're safe enough to get out on the line.
Well, what do they have to say to you, that they don't have health problems? Or I mean, what are the things they have to do to qualify?
So there are different levels of training that you have to go to act in the various capacities of wildland firefighting. The red card allows you to get on the front line and actually dig dirt next to the flame, holding it up and trying to remove the fuel that might propel the fire. That's about a week-long class, and you have to prove physical fitness through that. There's also the blue card training, which is we provided for some of the folks that donated their equipment to the cause. That's a simpler one. It's basic safety standards and allows them to work away from the line and build the outside containment and still do it in a manner that's safe and effective.
Mm-hmm. So red and blue cards, I hear at least a week's training for one of the cards. How many people responded when you put the call out for help?
We've had more than 5,000 people respond.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And how many of those are you able to work with?
From the red cards, again, from what they told us, and we're in the process of verifying this now, and what we were able to train over the weekend, we've got about 600 qualified firefighters we can add into the roster.
Wow. And so digging next to a fire line, in reporting only, I've been on fire lines. Very frightening. You never know when the wind's going to switch. How are they handling it?
They've been anxious to get out there, and we've put them in situations where they're not in the most danger, so we ensure safety that way. From what I've been told, from what I've heard back from the few that I've heard back from, they are really excited to be able to help out.
In fact, we had planned to have a few of the volunteers with you, but they're out doing work. I mean, we feel guilty talking to you. There's barely time because there's so much to do. Outside of the firefighters that you've invited in from Australia and New Zealand, what if, the average American sitting across the country thinks, I've got a few weeks, let me come out, I'll pay for my expenses. Would you take people from out of state?
Right now, based on the response we've gotten, we really don't feel like we have any more need. We feel like we've gotten the addition to the force that we needed. We did get some firefighters from Idaho and Oregon who have been added into the roster.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we were reminded of the danger not very far from where you are. Those three firefighters died. It was during the Twisp fire last week. It was a car accident. Still, it just reminds us of the danger, these three young men. Did that deter people, do you think, or maybe encourage them to come out in their honor in some funny way?
A lot of the people that we heard from did volunteer because of the deaths. They saw that happen and channeled their emotions in the best way they knew how to help and offering up their bodies and their services to us.
Yeah, quite something. We are reading that officials there say that this fire could go to the 1st of November.
That's right. That's right.
Are you going to have enough people then?
Yeah. I mean, by then it'll hopefully be contained and smaller, and it'll just be a matter of putting out the hot spots and making sure it doesn't flare back up. But until we get some real serious rainfall and snow, this fire should go on for a long time.
Yeah. Obviously, there are people who love the area, but we understand this fire from people we've spoken with. It's shaken people up. Are people talking about leaving the area or literally digging in? I mean, you're talking about volunteers digging. So what are you hearing?
Just around town here, I see a lot of frustration and a lot of just hopelessness from the people that live here. A lot of them lived through the previous largest fire in state history last year. Right in this area too, and just are worn out.
Those were the Carlton Complex fires. Worn out. And just as we let you go, you remind us it is wearing. Remind us why. What, obviously, if you're digging and you're fighting a fire, that's wearing. But even just to have it present.
Right. I mean, just the smoke in the air wears on you. It does affect your breathing. And then the ability not to see the wide open spaces that are so beautiful here the rest of the year, the reason that people live here, not knowing if your home is safe or if you've lost everything or if your cows, there's a lot of ranchers out here, if your cattle are being burned up, well, you can't respond. You can't get out to them. It's just a lot of lives and livelihoods on the line.
You know, hearing that, you can understand why somebody would say, I got to do something and volunteer. And on the other side, it must be really heartwarming to see. It's like an old-fashioned, you know, brigade.
That's right. Getting these phone calls and going through these emails has been a tremendous experience in seeing the good of the human spirit. They can't sit here and watch, and they can't imagine the tragedy the people who live here are going through, and they want to come do anything they can to help out.
Well, Joe Smiley, again, with the Washington State Department of Natural Resources, just best of luck to you fighting those fires there in the state. Best of luck.
Thank you, Robin.
All this week, we're talking about immigration. Yesterday, we heard from a couple of undocumented immigrants. Tomorrow, we'll hear from some people who have immigrated legally. But in almost every conversation you hear about immigration in this country, you'll hear the refrain that our immigration system is broken. Well, right now, we're joined by somebody who says that is not the case. Jan Ting is a professor at Temple University School of Law and a former assistant commissioner at what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Jan, welcome.
Hey, great to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, why do you think our system is not broken?
We have the most generous legal immigration system in the world, bar none. We admit more legal immigrants and give them green cards for legal permanent residence in the United States with a clear path to full citizenship than all the rest of the nations of the world combined. It seems to me that's about right. We should be the most generous nation in the world because we're the nation that's benefited from legal immigration more than any other nation in the world. My parents were immigrants. We have a great immigrant tradition. We also admit every year 80% of the resettled refugees in the world.
But we're not meeting the demand. We're not meeting the demand of all the people who do want to come here legally.
We will never meet the demand, right? Anyone who reads the papers knows that there's a worldwide migration crisis underway now. And the question for Americans is, should we let them all come to the United States? Because if we do, they will. We're going to have all kinds of problems. It seems to me what the American people want is a compromise. We're not going to let everyone in the world who wants to come to the United States. We're going to set a very generous number, and we're going to bring them to the United States and try to integrate them into our society.
What about the people who are here illegally already, the 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country?
Well, the hard part about trying to enforce a limitation on immigration is having to turn away people who remind us of our own ancestors, right, who just want to work hard. They're not criminals. They just want a better life for themselves and their families. And because we're going to have a numerical limitation, even a generous one, it means we're going to have to say no to those people.
And what do you mean say no to them? But
we're going to say, you can't come. You can't come to the United States. And if you come in violation of our laws, we're going to have to try and remove you from the United States.
But again, what about the people who are already here? What do you do with them?
Well, I'm just saying part of deterrence is saying if you get past the border and into the United States, you cannot live securely. You are going to be subject to removal if you come to the attention of the authorities.
But is it feasible to remove 11 million people?
That is not the question. That is a straw man.
How is that a straw man?
Obviously, you know, you cannot abolish murder in this country by having laws against murder, right? And you cannot abolish illegal immigration by having laws against illegal immigrants. But what you can do is you can reduce the incidence of the problem. You can reduce the problem by enforcing the nation's immigration laws against the people that violate our laws. And, you know, Donald Trump has just come out with an immigration paper, which I think is going to be very politically significant. And he says, you know, a nation without borders is not really a nation, and a nation nation that doesn't enforce its laws is not really a nation. And he says the purpose of immigration law is to protect the jobs and the wages and the security of the American people. And I think those are principles that are going to resonate with the American people. And I think immigration is going to become the central issue in this political campaign. I think it already has become the central issue. And Americans are going to have to decide, do we want to have a restrictive immigration system that depends on deterrence to keep the number of illegal immigrants low, or do we want to just let everyone come in?
When you say part of this is about protecting the jobs, I just want to quote a couple of studies here. This is from the Kauffman Foundation. It says between 2006 and 2012, more than two-fifths of the startup tech companies in Silicon Valley had at least one foreign-born founder. And the Partnership for a New American Economy says immigrants founded 28% of all new small businesses in 2011. Is there really evidence that having more immigrants, even more unauthorized immigrants in this country, leads to a taking away of jobs that Americans would take anyway?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, all those little startups don't employ very many people. You know, if you think about the job losses that we've had in this country, those occurred during the time of all these startups. I mean, even Facebook and Google, the big successful tech giants out in the Silicon Valley, really don't employ very many people compared to the manufacturing industry that we used to have in the United States.
But what numbers would you point to show that having more undocumented immigrants leads to fewer jobs for Americans?
I would just point to the fact that the American people have great anxiety over job insecurity right now. The American people have been suffering from low wages, stagnant wages, even though the government keeps telling us the economy's on the upswing, right? And the question is, if the stock market is up and profits are up, how come wages are stagnant? How come so many Americans have to string together part-time jobs to try and keep it together?
But what does that have to do with illegal immigration?
How come 46 million Americans are on food stamps, one out of six? And this has to do with immigration because all of these things occurred at a time of high immigration to the United States. It's not a coincidence, I think, that almost all the job growth that has happened in the United States over the last 10 years, there's a study from the Center for Immigration Studies that says this, all the job growth in the last 10 years has been equal to the number of immigrant workers that have come into the United States. So, you know, all the job growth has in effect been taken up by immigration. American workers are suffering from low wages, job insecurity, worrying about whether their kids are going to have as good a life as the older generation has had. Those are real anxieties, and the politicians that recognize it are going to be successful in this election cycle, and the politicians who ignore that reality are going to pay a price.
You know, I asked you about the undocumented immigrants who are in this country and what to do about them, those who are already here. What about the dreamers, the people who really know no other country? They were brought here at such a young age that they've been brought up in the U.S., and this is what they know as home.
Well, I think everyone would concede that among the illegal alien population, the dreamers, the so-called dreamers, are probably the most sympathetic subgroup for exactly the reasons that you've said. And I think that there was a tactical error on the part of the immigration advocates in that they didn't from early on present a single bullet bill that would just address the situation of those individuals.
But what about the Dream Act, though?
Well, I think it was presented too late after the immigration issue had been inflamed by the debate over so-called comprehensive immigration reform that in the end did not have the votes to pass.
You mentioned Donald Trump earlier, and I just want to come back to what he has said. And he has kicked off this conversation in large part because of what he was saying about Mexican immigrants bringing crime. They're coming in as rapists, bringing drugs. Do you think that the rhetoric goes too far and demonizes people who all they want to do is come over and have a better life for themselves and their family?
I think Donald Trump's rhetoric taps into what the American people are feeling. And on the issue of criminal aliens, you know, in the month of July, as you know, he's talked about illegal immigrant Mexicans as being murderers and rapists. Well, in the month of July, there were at least three American women that we know of who were murdered by illegal immigrant Mexican people, men, who were not only in the country illegally, should not have been here, but whose presence was known to state and local and federal authorities who did nothing.
But we know that overall, the unauthorized immigrant population, the crime rate is lower than the population at large.
Any crime committed by illegal immigrants who are not supposed to be here in the first place is a preventable crime. It's a crime that should not have happened. I think the American people are outraged. And I think, again, you know, we've got an election campaign coming up, and we'll soon see, you know, which candidates are able to tap into the authentic feelings of the American people.
But you don't think the rhetoric has gone too far?
I think it taps into the reality of what the American people are feeling.
Do you think that there is any element of racism to people who are vehemently against immigration, illegal immigration?
Well, sure. You know, especially if you use the word any. I think a lot of people feel great unease about their jobs, about their wages, about the future for their children. And if you ask them, well, why do you feel that way? And they'll come out with something like, gosh, there seems like there's Mexicans everywhere, you know, which is obviously a racist statement. But, you know, the American people are not all radio hosts, you know, who are articulate and able to express what they're feeling clearly. So I think, sure, there's an element of racism that edges into the debate, I think almost inadvertently. It's not that people are really racist. It's just that they don't know how else to express the anxiety that they're feeling about things changing around them and causing them all this insecurity.
Jan Ting, a professor at Temple University School of Law and former assistant commissioner at what was the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Jan Ting, thank you for joining us.
Jeremy, always a pleasure.
And you can leave your thoughts and hear our other conversations at hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, as we continue our series on immigration, we'll hear from two people who came here legally.
So we went back to Brazil and expected to wait for 5 years. And we eventually got a letter to receive our visa 11 years later.
That conversation tomorrow on Here and Now.
And you know origami, the art of folding paper to create intricate sculptures. Think of the origami cranes, symbol of peace. Origami was first practiced as far back as the 6th century, and now there's a 3D photo origami. It's high-tech science that middle school kids in Boulder, Colorado are learning about this summer. Jenny Brundin from Here Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports.
11-year-old Elliot Huang admits if he were at home on this hot summer day, he'd play Pokemon. But here he is huddled around a heat lamp at the CU Science Discovery Camp.
It's an excuse to get out.
He and his friends are doing a version of innovative engineering research called photo origami, involving light-activated 3D structures. Elliot says he's having a lot of fun. He's the kind of kid when you point to the giant periodic table on the wall and ask him what his favorite element is, he doesn't skip a beat.
I like iron because of its handiness for a bunch of stuff, and ytterbium just because it's spelled funny and it's so fun to say.
Today, he and his friends watch a bit of magic take place. They have tiny strips of shape memory polymer, a.k.a. Shrinky Dink. Teacher Eric Carpenter prepares them for what they'll see once the polymer sheets go under the heat lamp.
It takes about 30 seconds because we need to heat that polymer up to about 300 degrees.
We've already got it.
Once that polymer gets to 300 degrees, you'll see it wiggle, you'll see it lift, then you'll see it lay back down.
Oh my goodness, it's bending up crazy.
The kids watch the shapes bend and fold under the heat.
That is the sound of cutting-edge science.
Wow.
What they're doing mimics sophisticated research taking place at the University of Colorado Boulder's College of Engineering and Applied Science just down the road. Researchers there are developing new materials that are engineered to fold in certain places when exposed to light. It's called photo origami. Research associate Beth Stade says she and her colleagues like to share what they're learning with middle and high school students, but they just couldn't bring them into this tiny lab.
But what we realized is that we could do all the same bending with Shrinky-Dink, which is a shape memory polymer that's thermal activated. So instead of being activated by light, it's being activated by heat.
25 kids are in their lab now conducting their own experiments with the polymer strips. How does the thickness of the lines they draw change the way the sheets fold? How does material bend based on the pen's color? For 9-year-old Molly Urbanus, it's this science, the discovery of new things, that's the fun part.
I've never been able to make other shapes besides what the package gave me. So I'm very curious to find out what the Shrinky-Dink material is going to do.
And there is no shortage of ideas when I ask the kids what they think photo origami can be used for in the future.
You can make a portable robot that would shrink up and maybe move if you had the mechanics to do it.
The military could deal with insurgents, mines, maybe. It could be used for espionage. It could be like a small package in someone's thing to like rise up and become like a cell tower or something. Or a portable cell phone. Yeah.
The fact is, these students are asking questions, trying new things, just like the graduate students, says research associate Beth Stade.
The graduate students will say, well, what if we pre-stress it? I've heard students say, what if I pre-bend my Shrinky-Dink? The conversations are exactly the same. So the materials are different, the labs are different, the scientific process is identical.
Giving young people an idea of what it's like to be an engineer. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brundine.
Mount Everest is once again open for business. This week, Nepal's Minister of Tourism granted the first permit to climb since last April's devastating earthquake, and the permit went to Japanese mountaineer Nobukazu Kuriki. The mountain had been closed off after the quake, killed thousands across Nepal, and triggered avalanches on Everest that killed 19 climbers and injured and stranded dozens more. China immediately closed the northern Tibetan side, and on the Nepal side, all but one climbing team canceled their trips. And now Kuriki is on his way on a new trip set to climb in September. Will that bring back not only climbers, but tourists, the mainstay of Nepal's economy? Peter Athens has summited Everest seven times. He's a climbing guide, co-director of the Khumbu Climbing Center. That's a vocational school for indigenous people living near Everest. And he's also become something of an unofficial ambassador for the country and joins us by Skype. Pete, welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
And your thoughts on Everest reopening?
I think it was inevitable. I think that it's time for the peak to be opened again. I think it's high time for people to say, okay, Nepal has gone through this devastating event. People are rebuilding. The Nepalese people are, I think, amongst the most enduring people I could possibly imagine. And they're open for business. They want people to come. They want people to see not only what the beautiful mountains look like, but what their culture is like and its incredible depth and variety.
Well, but and surely you want to support that, but might it go wrong? This climber, Kuriki, has never summited. He's had several failed attempts, and it's, we understand, not the best time of year to do it.
The fall season is definitely more of a challenging season. It has a tendency to become very windy once you arrive into early October. Obviously, the days are getting shorter. It's getting colder, which is a complete opposite from the season in the spring, whereas your acclimatization is getting better through April and May. The days are getting longer. They're usually getting a little bit warmer. There's longer light. So that's absolutely true. It's a challenging season. And the gentleman who's going to climb will definitely have a difficult time in front of him, no doubt about it.
Well, in fact, he's got some history behind him that's just incredible. He lost parts of 9 fingers after getting frostbitten on his last attempt, and part of this attempt is going to be solo. So he's drawing that attention. The question is, will he draw other climbers? And another question is, what about the Sherpas? Most of the 19 climbers who were killed in the avalanches triggered by the earthquake were Sherpas. And then the previous year, 16 died in 2014. Their colleagues, we remember this, stopped work to mourn the dead, but also demand better treatment, better payment. What's your sense of the Sherpas and how they're being treated?
My sense is that there is still quite a bit of work yet to do to redress the social conditions there. But there have been some significant changes and some significant improvements. And were you to ask the Sherpas themselves, respective to whether the mountain should be open or closed, I think you would definitely hear a unanimous, they would like to have it open. The gentleman who will be going to climb while he's calling it a solo ascent, I'm not entirely sure what he means by it. I know that there will be probably, something on the order of 10 or 11 icefall doctors, some of the people that I helped to train, who will be working on opening up the Khumbu Icefall, or the glacier that goes from about 17,000 feet to 19,600 feet.
And let's explain, icefall doctors are these incredible people who go and fix the ladders and the implements that are in place so that people can climb.
Absolutely, Robin. You hit the nail on the head. And truthfully, they are the icefall engineers. They work with aluminum extension ladders, miles of fixed line, materials to help anchor the ropes in place called pickets, and a variety of other tools to try to make what is essentially a hanging skyway through the Everest icefall. And it's nothing short of remarkable what they do.
Well, in your point, nobody really climbs alone. But you also make another point that you really want people to hear. It's not just climbers that Nepal needs to come back. It's tourists.
Absolutely. I think it's time for people to take away those diminishing thoughts of Nepal being dangerous to travel in. I think that going into the Everest region, the Annapurna region, some of the more popular trekking routes, and even just visiting the Kathmandu Valley or the Pokhara Valley themselves are still very fulfilling and definitely help the economy. Because obviously we know that the devastating nature of those earthquakes and those tremors and aftershocks, but having the economy, I think, held in check as a result of people not coming to visit will be far worse over the long term.
Well, Pete, actually, you're working on a documentary about the reconstruction efforts there. You love the country, and many people would love to go, but will they find the same Nepal? Will they find the place of mysticism and you know, kind of an old world? Is it still there?
I don't want to try to soften some of the images that people have already seen, the loss of some of the heritage monuments in that place. But having just returned to the West from Nepal, having been there for the last 3.5 weeks, there's much of the same place that brought me to love the place, call it my second home, since I first arrived there in the early 1980s. So I'm encouraging everybody to go. I was there with my 10 and 12-year-old and my wife, and I felt like it was still as wonderful as it's ever been. Obviously, there's a lot of challenges that face the country, but for those of us who love the place and those of us who are interested in finding out whether they love it, now's the time to go.
What's the one thing, you know how you can pack altruistically? One thing you can tuck in your suitcase if you go to Nepal?
Oh, I think the probably some of the most important things, bring some children's illustrated books. If you have any extra books, you can pass out to some kids and some of the remote areas. Okay. Bring some toothbrushes. Bring some small traveler-sized toothpastes for people. Any type of little analgesics, little medicines, Advil, any painkillers, little things like that, over-the-counter things, would definitely be very much appreciated with the health posts that are available in some of those areas where people might be visiting.
And as you say, just go. Pete Athens, climbing guide and someone who's made Nepal his home for quite a while, second home for quite a while, working on a documentary about reconstruction there. Pete, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate the time with everyone.
And now let's get an update on that horrifying shooting of a local TV reporter and her cameraman live on air in Central Virginia this morning. 27-year-old cameraman Adam Ward, 24-year-old reporter Allison Parker, both dead. Virginia police say the gunman is Vester Flanagan, a disgruntled former station reporter who's in critical condition after shooting himself. Here now is Peter O'Dowd, who's been monitoring this today. And Peter, as you know, we've discussed this. We've chosen not to air
right. The
sound that stunned viewers heard and the video they saw this morning at about 6:45. But the shooter also wore something like a GoPro and also posted video?
Right. If we think the first video that we saw this morning was chilling and disturbing, well, the video that the alleged shooter put up today on his social media sites, even worse. You see the perspective of this scene from the turned around perspective. So it's a familiar scene that we saw earlier in the morning, but from a different perspective. The shooter walks up to the reporters and the interview subject, and it actually gets very close to the cameraman and pauses there for quite a while before the shooting happens.
It's just horrific. Well, what more do we know about the alleged shooter? We have an excerpt of an on-air report by the suspect, Vester Flanagan. He went by the honor name Bryce Williams.
Well, this all started this afternoon with some type of an argument at a trailer park on
Niblet
Drive.
There he is reporting on an earlier story. Some sound there, of course. We're seeing a lot of sound of him now. What more do we know about him?
41 years old, spent two decades working in television news, and like a lot of TV reporters, bounced around to a lot of markets. He had worked in Savannah, Georgia. He had worked in San Francisco. He'd also worked in Florida. So one reporter from Virginia that NBC quoted is saying that he was kind of like the joke of the market, that he had this outsized personality. He had a big temper, but that he wasn't necessarily all that good at what he was doing.
Well, he was black, and his victims today were white, and we understand he'd filed racial discrimination complaints against the reporter and other members of the staff. The ABC is reporting that they received a 23-page fax from someone claiming to be the shooter. It was also a rant about racism at the station. But, of course, we have no idea. We'll keep an ear on this, but a story that has, you know, race, live television, workplace rage, social media, and just a devastating, devastating moment that a lot of people were witness to. Here now is Peter O'Dowd updating on us on this story out of Virginia Today. Again, a local reporter and cameraman shot dead live during the morning programming today. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
It was 10 years ago today that the governor of Louisiana declared a state of emergency as Hurricane Katrina gained strength over the Gulf of Mexico. 3 days later, Katrina made landfall and changed parts of this country forever. So how was Katrina and the aftermath portrayed on television? How has it been? Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
And Eric, let's start with how the storm has been portrayed on TV in fictional shows.
We have not seen many scripted TV shows based around Katrina. Fox had a cop show called K-ville that lasted about a season. There have been fantasy shows like CW has a show called The Originals, and FX had a show called American Horror Story Coven that took place in New Orleans. But the best known scripted TV show to deal with Katrina and its aftermath has to be HBO's Tremé. And we've got a clip from the opening scene. Let's check it out.
Shorty gonna make it, huh? No.
So this, you know, Tremé was created by David Simon, who folks know from The Wire. And folks know from watching The Wire that he has a very detailed way of recreating the feel of a city. And so Tremé was really great at sort of taking you into New Orleans post-Katrina. You saw the lives of the musicians and regular people just trying to put their lives back together again. Really evocative take on what it was like in the early days as the city tried to recover from the flood.
There's also been an NCIS New Orleans, right?
Yeah, well, that's my example of a show that maybe wasn't so good that was set in New Orleans, but it doesn't tell these elemental truths about the area in the way that Tremé tried to do and often did.
Okay, well, we've been talking here about some of the entertainment television that's come out of Katrina, but what about the TV journalism that has come out of the storm?
Well, certainly when the crisis was in full flower, right after the storm passed New Orleans, the levees broke and the city was being flooded, television journalism in particular was crucial. It brought the pictures of the devastation and the flooding and people struggling to survive. And it also showed us the images of a government that was failing to respond to the emergency and save people. And we were seeing the plight of people who were stuck in that city and weren't able to evacuate before the storm hit because they were poor and they didn't have resources. And so it brought all these issues of poverty, and because poverty is disproportionately involving people of color in New Orleans, issues of race. One of the journalists, for example, who really excelled in the midst of this coverage was NBC's Brian Williams. He wrote out the storm and the Superdome and then spent a long time reporting on what happened there, and then took his reports for NBC Nightly News and for MSNBC and put them into a documentary. And we have a clip featuring some coverage from that show. Let's check it out.
The politics of all this are very simple. If we come out of this crisis and in the next couple of years don't have a national conversation on the following issues, race, class, petroleum, the environment, then we, the news media, will have failed by not keeping people's feet to the fire.
And of course, hearing Brian Williams now, we have a different view of him because of what's happened at NBC. But even some of his reporting in Katrina has been called into question, right?
Well, there was some questions. You know, he claimed to have seen floating bodies and dead bodies at a time when other people didn't recall seeing them. But I think the bulk of his reporting was focused on things that you could actually see, things that were captured on the camera. He was reporting what a lot of people were reporting at the time. But what's interesting is to note that quote that he said, where he talked about it was time for the news media to focus on poverty, focus on race, focus on class, focus on the environment. And I went and talked to Brian Williams about 5 years after he made that statement, and he had to admit that he wasn't able to turn even his own news broadcast attention sufficiently to those topics because there was a certain amount of Katrina fatigue, and the news media has a hard time offering sustained coverage of poverty and race in this country because those are issues I think that middle class news consumers are not necessarily interested in when you get outside of crisis elements, crisis situations like Katrina.
Well, and you could say that about almost any big story now. What, you know, a mass shooting happens, and 2 weeks later, the news media have completely turned to another topic.
Certainly. But in this case, I think what Katrina revealed was that there were ongoing systemic stories about how race and class and poverty work in America that journalists could have really dug into and done sustained reporting on. Our challenge as journalists is to not be distracted by shiny objects all the time and not chase the thing that is the spot news all the time and find ways to talk about these systemic issues. I have a book called Race Baiter. And there's one chapter called The Katrina Effect, where I talked about how little poverty was covered on the national news outlets, even when we were in the midst of the Great Recession. We have to figure out ways to get the news media focused on these systemic issues beyond the anniversary of Katrina or beyond the spot news of a flood that brings forth these issues in a way that you can't ignore.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.